Hello, good afternoon, everyone. Hello and welcome to the Alaska World Affairs Council. My name is Lisa Falsko. I'm the CEO, and it's such a pleasure to see everyone today on this fine, sunshiny day. Our speaker has promised that this is to continue, and he's brought it all with him, so I'm excited about that. If you could please take a moment to turn off your cell phones. This program will be recorded for KSKA, so if you could put it on vibrate, we'd greatly appreciate that. I'd like to thank William Toyer, who is doing the recording today for KSKA. And if you'd like to hear this program or any of the previous programs, you can go to their website at alaskapublic.org and just search for AWAC Presents, and you'll be able to see and listen to this program as well as our previous programs. We'll also be drawing here in a few minutes the breadbasket raffle. So if you haven't picked up your raffle ticket, you have just a couple minutes to rush to the front table and get a raffle ticket for a great basket donated by Great Harvest Bread Company. We are a membership organization, and memberships expired at the end of June. So if you're currently not a member, please consider joining our organizations. We have some cards on the table, and you can fill out those cards, or you can sign up online at alaskaworldaffairs.org. We also have comment cards on the table. They look like this. And if you have any comments about this program or any of our past programs or have any ideas about future programs, please take a moment to fill out a comment card and let us know what you think. We're happy to hear from you. If this is your first World Affairs Council, could you raise your hand? Do we have any first-time people? Okay, wow, great. Welcome to the Alaska World Affairs Council. And if you like this program, our next program is going to be a partnership with UAA. We will be at the Student Union on the UAA campus the evening of October 5th at 7:30. And it will be a free program sponsored by UAA. And this will be featuring Chris Abani, a gentleman who is from Nigeria. If you're a student, if you wouldn't mind standing and being recognized, we'd love to recognize any students who are here today. Fantastic.
Whoa.
Thank you so much for coming. And thank you to BP for sponsoring our student programs, which allows them to come to our programs at no cost. Thank you, BP. And now I'd like to ask Kari to come up with our bread basket raffle basket. And ask our speaker to,
oh, I get to
draw the lucky person.
Oh, all righty. There we go.
Okay. I hope you have a red ticket. The number is 567-893. 567-893. Do we have a winner for today's? Ah! Fantastic. Congratulations. Oh, Macon. Okay. You're going to have to wrestle the lady next to you. I think she was pretty excited about that Great Harvest basket. And now I'd like to bring to the podium Roger Hudson from Results, who's responsible for making this program possible today. We'd like to thank Roger Hudson and ask him to introduce our people.
Thank you. My name is Roger Hudson. My day job is I'm an attorney with the Department of Interior. But my avocation for the last 30 years has been as a results volunteer, working to create the political will to end poverty. And results volunteers basically make it their business to see that their elected representatives are well informed about issues of global public health, education, and development assistance, including microcredit, in regard to which Results has a 25-year history of advocacy. Now, AWAC has provided a very informative and thorough biographical profile of both our moderator and our speaker, so I commend you to that for additional information, but I want to add something a little different. I first met Eric about 8 years ago when he showed up for a results fundraising event here in town. And coincidentally, John Hatch was our featured star attraction speaker for that fundraising event. Eric kind of sat in the crowd and listened with great interest. But then after the fact, he kind of drew attention to himself, as far as I was concerned, by being the most generous contributor who attended the event. And I since came to learn that that was because of his already confirmed interest in microcredit as a poverty alleviation strategy. Besides his most thankless and hopeless task here in town of being my personal golf improvement coach, Eric is a very busy guy. As the profile indicates, he founded a very successful business and was able to take kind of an early retirement. And what he's been doing with himself since then is he's been extremely busy and generously using his time and his financial resources to support and involve himself in a wide variety of public service endeavors, both for the betterment of the Anchorage and Alaska community and for the global community. And most relevant to our topic today, Eric is a founding guarantor and board member of Microcredit Enterprises, which if you look it up on the web, it's mcenterprises.org. And that organization supplies $25 million of funding to 35 different microenterprise type programs in 20 countries. And that's really a great contribution that Eric's making in that regard. And so we're really glad to have him here to, you know, engage in the conversation with John. John Hatch is somebody that I first ran into in the late 1980s at a debriefing meeting on Capitol Hill after a day of lobbying Don and Frank and Ted, because that's what we results volunteers do. We travel back and engage with our elected congressional representatives. Of course, one of the issues we were already lobbying on at that time was microcredit and trying to make sure that it was part of the U.S. international development strategy. When I first saw John, he stood up and shared about how his day had gone during our lobbying, and he was very visibly moved by what he had to report that had occurred that day. He had been working for quite a while knocking on the doors of our U.S. Foreign Aid Agency, United States Agency for International Development, to try to get them to allocate some of their funding that results had gotten Congress to tell them had to be spent on microcredit to get them to start working with his organization, FINCA, the Foundation for International Community Assistance. And at that time, he finally was able to break through and get the first contract between AID and FINCA for FINCA to administer one of the programs that our foreign aid was supporting. And that link really helped FINCA to pretty dramatically scale up and expand. They were able to develop microcredit programs in a lot more countries and reach a lot more poor people with microcredit loans. And from that time forward, it was real obvious to me that John cares very deeply about low-income people, and he's been able to make a huge contribution to the lives of literally millions. The FINCA website says that as of now, they have a portfolio of 900,000 current microcredit loans in 21 countries. And from the time that he started out in 1962 as one of the first generation of Peace Corps volunteers until now, John has combined the qualities of being a very practical, hands-on administrator of foreign assistance type programs and being an original thinker and a visionary. And to give you some context, in the 1980s and even into the mid-1990s, there were only several million people who had access to microcredit lending programs around the world. Many countries didn't have any of those programs. But now, as of today, microcredit lending is available to somewhere on the order of 130 million or 140 million households around the world. And in no small measure, that's because John helped conceive of the idea of a microcredit summit campaign. And in 1997, results helped organize this campaign. We had a huge summit meeting in Washington, D.C., attended by people from about 130 countries, practitioners of microcredit, as well as government officials and others. And that summit led to the adoption of a goal of reaching 100 million of the world's poor households with microcredit. At the time, I think there were about 7 million in 1997 people with access to microcredit loans. So they had a 10-year goal of increasing the scale by a factor of 14-fold. And we were about 1 year late, but in 2008, we actually achieved that goal of reaching 100 million of the world's poorest families. And then we, of course, went on to develop a new goal, which is to reach 175 million households and to actually see 100 million of those households climb out of absolute poverty in terms of what their household incomes are. So all that incredible progress and all the transformation it's brought to the lives of many millions of poor people around the world is due in no small measure to John's pioneering work, both with Mike, with developing the village banking model and with his global vision as implemented through the Microcredit Summit campaign. And, you know, Muhammad Yunus, his co-conspirator in proselytizing and bringing the value of microcredit to the world, he got the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006. And John didn't, but and he didn't get a big check, but in looking him up on Wikipedia today, I saw that he is the 2009 recipient of the Peace Corps Association's Sergeant Shriver Award for Distinguished Humanitarian Service, which I think is unbelievably richly rewarded. So I've droned on too long, and so let's hear from Eric and John. Thanks.
So thanks, Roger, very much, and thanks, Lisa, for having us at the World Affairs Council. Mary, you need to stand up. Mary is Roger's partner and cohort in crime for 30 years with results. So, and there, behind every stumbling man, there's always smart women. So, so since we have so many young people here, this is great. How many people know about microcredit in the room? Great, great. So I think that helps us lead into the first question, which, you know, John, just briefly describe microcredit and Finca's mission, if you would, for a lot of the people who don't maybe understand what microcredit is.
Could I first introduce my wife, who is basically the godmother of village banking worldwide. Mimi, would you please stand up? Behind every stumbling activist is a strong woman, somebody said, you know? Okay. Now, the question was...
Just briefly describe microcredit and Finca's mission, if you will.
Okay, microcredit, it's also called microfinance, is a methodology for providing financial services to very low-income families. And it has divided itself up into different kinds of methodologies. It's a broad movement that includes both individual lending programs to individual loans to single borrowers, and it also has many versions of group lending, where groups of women especially, in the group lending, about 80 to 90% of their members are female, many of them single mothers trying to support 3-4 kids all by themselves. That's the type of program that Finca got started doing. In our methodology, we called village banking. It's basically like giving very poor people a chance to come together in a solidarity group and create their own informal credit union, where everybody saves, where everybody has a right to take out a loan, they collect the money, they do it all themselves. It is. If you want to identify it, think of all the things that the banking community does, and then think the exact opposite. That's what microcredit is. If commercial banks lend mostly to men, we lend to women. If they require a lot of paperwork, application forms and stuff, our loans are almost instant. If they require you to come into the bank to get your loan and talk to a loan officer, our loan officers go out to the community. It's a program of bottom-up self-help
collateral. Collateral. Collateral, you know, banks, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We don't require collateral like banks do. Actually, we have a form of collateral, and that is the solidarity guarantee of the group itself. If one member doesn't pay off, the rest of the group stands up and takes care of that balance until the person who didn't pay is able to make up on their loan and repay the group. So that has led to a loan recovery rates within the microfinance movement that in the case of Finca, we're at a 98 and 99% loan recovery rate. It's just astonishing how faithful very, very poor families are in repaying this money because they find it so useful to improving their lives, and they don't want to risk losing this one-in-a-lifetime opportunity to help build their little family business, generate that extra $2 a day in family income. That really means the difference between whether their kids eat or not, whether they stabilize some kind of family nutrition pattern or not, whether they can send their kids to school. It's just like a difference of $2 a day for the average client of microcredit that can begin to revolutionize their lives and begin to give them the capacity to lift themselves out of poverty. Just on Fink itself, we started in Bolivia in 1984. We're now in 22 countries around the world. We have programs in Latin America, Africa, a couple in the Middle East, Afghanistan, and Jordan. We have Eastern Europe programs, and we are about to acquire, we're actually going to buy our first program, an existing microcredit bank that serves 300,000 families in Pakistan. And it's just a really big challenge, and I can't think of a more deserving place to do this because in the statistics of child infant mortality, the five countries with the biggest infant mortality rates, one of them is Pakistan.
Okay, so you've talked a little bit about some of the changes, but also, you know, cover what changes you've seen in third world credit and finance since you started in models, products, and people served.
Well, we talked a little bit about group credit and individual credit. In terms of the methodologies, I think we first have to look at the population pyramid of the world and recognize that of the 7 billion people out there, if we divide that into fifths, the lowest fifth of humanity is living on less than a dollar a day. And then the next fifth is between $1 and $2 a day, still quite poor. You don't even get into middle class until you are in between $3 and $5 a day. And then $5 to $10 a day. Think of it, four-fifths of humanity doesn't even come close to our living level that we enjoy being in the top fifth of the planet. We're in fact in the top one-tenth of the planet. And so the system of the world financial community has been to provide credit. Up to 20 years ago, it provided credit through the banking system and through cooperatives, but only to the very top rungs of that pyramid. There's a saying that says, if you don't, if you get a loan from a bank, it's because you don't need the money. You know, they only lend to people who don't really need the money. Three quarters to four fifths of the entire planet was disenfranchised from access to working capital. And so along came Muhammad Yunus 30 years ago with his Grameen Bank, and he said, you know, these are ladders of access to capital with only two rungs in them. But if you're at the very, very top, everybody else can't be served. So he built a new rung into the ladder at the level of a loan of $100 and began to go after extremely poor families. And then that precedent began to inspire other microfinance institutions, and some came in at $150 a day average loan, and then $200, and as our borrowers began to grow their businesses, they needed more credit, and slowly our institutions began to offer more and more loan products that began to fill out these ladders. And if you look at it now, after 30 years of development, historians in the future are going to look back at this period and say, this is one of the most important periods in the history of capitalism, of world capitalism, because now you can hardly find a nation on the planet which doesn't have a ladder of access to capital, which starts very close to the ground, and if you get on the first rung, you have some place to grow up that ladder. That is an enormous contribution. And so what we take for granted is something that has been created in the last 30 years throughout the rest of the planet. And historically, that is huge. I think that's, I don't know if I caught enough of your question.
Yeah, no. I mean, also, but to cover like some of the interesting models, like savings and insurance and some of the health programs and education that have been tied into microcredit.
Okay. Well, the large majority of microcredit has really focused on credit and savings programs. Often this is the more you save in your little group, the more you're entitled to borrow from the group. So there's that savings credit link, which is extremely important if you're going to help people get out of poverty. You don't get out of poverty by borrowing your way out of poverty. You get out of poverty by not spending. I mean, if what you manage to save is what really becomes the asset that you will eventually retire on and depend on when you get old. So there's the link between credit and savings. Then we've gotten into insurance products because many programs simply will insure the borrower so that in the case that he dies or she dies, their loan balance will be covered. They will get a burial expenses payout, and their savings will probably be doubled or tripled. That's part, and that'll be given to the survivors in the family. So that's where we got into insurance. Still in its infancy are insurance programs for health of the family. These have been very, very difficult to generalize, but it's one of our aspirations to learn how to do it. Another area that I am working gradually to get into FINCA's structure is something that we would know in this country as mutual insurance, where you insure where the account holder is actually an investor in the insurance company. And so the more you invest in these insurance products and the more the company grows, the more dividends you earn as one of its members, and it becomes a retirement account for our borrowers to fall back on in old age. Our microfinance programs also provide, depending on the country program, all of them in the group lending, I think, has gotten into empowerment, especially because they work with so many women, just empowerment motivation. Just the fact that a poor woman, joins a group, in many cases they're so poor they've never even had a chance to be in a group. They've never had friends. They've never had anybody who trusted them or hung out with them. So being in a group is self-empowering. Qualifying for credit is empowering. Getting their kids into school because of their little business is empowering. So it's like economic empowerment that combines with just the empowerment of feeling that they can as women. The difference between I can and I can't. And half the problem of poverty is breaking through from I can't to I can. And once that breakthrough occurs, and with a credit ladder that has been filled out, there's no stopping how far you can climb. Eventually, most of the programs in microcredit have reached break-even points. And that means that now they know that they will be around to fight another day. As long as they weren't paying their own way, they were dependent on grants. But now most of the movement is independent of grants. They are working on their own resources. They are becoming self-sufficient. And as they get into this sweet spot or comfort zone of self-sustaining, they now have the liberty to start saying, what are the other things poor people really need? Not just our borrowers, but those who aren't our borrowers yet, the really, really poor people. How can we reach them? How can we lend to beggars? How can we? There shouldn't be any kind of wall between that lowest fifth of humanity and everybody else. It's a myth to think that they have to be excluded because they're not eligible for credit. We want to make sure that we can break through that and look at programs that assist families with food security, how to keep kids in school, scholarships so they can go on to high school, home improvements such as clean water, electricity. In Africa, 90% of the population, even poor people now, have cell phones. There's a whole new evolving movement now technologically to move into cell phone technology so that people in even the most remote villages can do their banking by telephone. There's just huge changes on the way. And we call that part of the program that doesn't deal with specifically financial services, we call microcredit plus. And the social side is the plus. And it's getting deeper and bigger every day.
Great. So just a quick pitch for results. They're having a fundraiser tonight at 6:30, BP Energy Center. So, and then, so some of you may say, well, what is results really about? So talk a little bit about how results has impacted what the work you've done and FINCA's.
Well, if microfinance is a kind of an ingenious way of doing foreign aid, and we'll get to just how big it's become worldwide, but I think results is one of the most ingenious ways to it's again, if think of lobbyists in Congress, think of all the bad mouthing that we hear in the press and about the alligator shoes and the briefcases and these well-heeled corporate lobbyists going in and getting millions and millions of government funding for their particular projects. And then think of the exact opposite, and what you have is a volunteer lobbyist, a citizen's lobbyist, who doesn't get paid at all, but who lobbies Congress to make the right decisions on allocation bills that allocate resources to women, children, and infants, like food stamp program, earned income credit, Head Start, food stamps, all these things which are required in a democratic society to have everybody have a chance. So that's what Results does. It has an office in Washington that is tracking all legislation all the time and reading and finding out what provisions are coming down the line that affect women and children and infants. And then they focus in on those bills. Then they go out into Congress and they get different members of Congress to sign on as sponsors within their chamber to that particular aspect of the bill so that it won't be defined away or cut out. And so it's creating internal advocacy within our members of Congress. As a result, the result has been able to work in a bipartisan way for years and is considered one of the, if not the most effective lobbying force in Washington. And if you consider the amount of funding it has had a hand in directing to the poorest members of our society and the poor overseas, it is enormously leveraged. For every dollar that goes into results, it's $1,000 or more than that of impact out there that is going into programs that help poor people. Very powerful, very exciting, and Mimi introduced me to results. So she's been with the results how many years, Mimi? Well, she's only 30 years old now anyway, so you know, I think she's faking it, but 26, and she talked me into it. And then results learned about FINCA. Before I knew it, they were asking me to design with them the text of a first law, a piece of legislation called the Microcredit for the Poor Act, which was passed by Congress in 1988. And allocated several billion dollars to just this whole new idea. I had to testify before Congress and some other practitioners. We all advocated for this thing, and it became the first piece of legislation that went through, totally unanimously approved by both parties, and ever since then there have been three or four microcredit pieces of legislation that results have pushed, and every single one have sailed through Congress, including the most recent, even with the divided partisan Congress, because the whole idea of international assistance, market-driven, pay-for-itself, bottom-up economics. I mean, everybody loves it. There's something for everybody to like, and it's been enormously influential. Did that?
Yes. Yeah. So the final question, and I know we're running short on time, but you know, tie all this together to your topic. So how do we fill in the blanks? How do we end poverty by 2040?
Well, first of all, you'll have to come to the results of the fundraiser at 6:30 tonight in order to know the secret. No. But also, secondly, I want to take another brief pause and recognize the gentleman who won the lottery, the breadbasket lottery. Would you stand up, sir? He was the first person to greet me when I walked in the door here, and I introduced myself. He said, "How are you?" And I said, "I'm too blessed to be stressed."
Yeah.
And he said, "I love that so much. I'm going to remember that. Now, say it again. I want to remember it. I'm too blessed to be stressed." And what happened? He won the lottery. So, okay, to answer...
Macon, didn't you win that last month, too?
Okay, let me say, this is, first of all, you have to understand that the movement has grown fantastically. You have to know that this is the biggest phenomenon in international development that has ever been created historically. There are over 10,000 microfinance institutions worldwide. There are now, it's actually, I think, a little larger than what Roger said, 160 million families currently assisted by this movement worldwide. That's like a fifth of all humanity. And it's mostly bottom-up, it's mostly self-sustaining, it's something that is absorbing fewer and fewer taxpayer resources and generating more and more of its own growth income for reinvestment to keep growing. So this is a movement that has reached approximately 6 million villages around the planet. It's like the world's most extensive banking system, if you think of it that way. No village without its little bank, except it's a bank that the villagers run themselves. And that is what you call a development infrastructure. It's like laying rails down for a railway, like the Transcontinental Railway, that when Lincoln approved that project, there were like maybe when it was done within the first 10 years, they put 1 million miles of track, or maybe it was 100,000 miles of track. And within a decade, there was like 1 million. And it just grew. It's infrastructure. And once you have rail infrastructure or road infrastructure, you create the opportunity for these other services. It's like adding cars onto behind the engine being microcredit, and then the other cars being health and housing and potable water and electricity and just all the different services that might be relevant to development. And so that's what's happening out there. It's a movement so large that it is impossible for governments to control it anymore. In fact, a lot of the static you hear about microcredit today is because I think governments, out of a jealousy or out of a fear of losing control in certain countries, are afraid that they're going to get voted out of office, because these are huge voting blocks of voters who can support any candidate. So it's like a huge movement, and it's created a huge infrastructure, and it's growing at a rate of about at least 10% a year. So all I'm doing is just projecting from the current 160 million and adding about 30 million to that every year, and that's about the rate at which this thing is occurring. And finally, a secondary indicator, which blows my mind. I don't know how it'll affect you, but when I started in the Peace Corps and saw my first baby swollen and dying of malnutrition, and saw his little white coffin carted away, it hit me finally that poverty kills. That's when I first learned that it did that, and so that's when I made a decision that this is what I wanted to do as a career. After Peace Corps, I was going to get into economic development. And so that, to the young people in the room, I'm glad there's so many of you, because there is no better investment of your time than joining the Peace Corps. You'll not only pick up a language, total fluency in a language, but experience with how the other world lives, the kind of experience that when you come home, it'll place you head and shoulders above all the competition in the job market. And many, many, many activists in microcredit today are ex-Peace Corps. So this, where I'm getting at finally on this thing about from where I learned about poverty kills, in those days, approximately 14 million, maybe even more, 16 million children around the world were dying of chronic malnutrition and hunger-related disease. That was in the years 1965, 70, when I was in the Peace Corps. Today, that number has come down to less than 6 million. It's 6.8 million children now, estimated by UNICEF, dying each day from chronic malnutrition. That, to me, is the best indicator of what's left to do. If you extrapolate out, that's about 6 or 7 million families that we have to reach, families with single mothers, families whose children are really with a high risk of dying. And if we focus on them, we could easily bring that mortality rate to virtually zero over the next 10, 15 years. And I'm just being generous, thinking that it's going to take us to 2040 in order to end poverty. If we end child-infant malnutrition anytime soon, that will be the best indicator of all that we've ended poverty, because the price of poverty is paid in the lives of these babies. So that's where we're focused. We're making great progress, and it's growing very quickly, and it's, as some people like to say, it's too big to fail. But it's all bottom up. This is globalization, but it's from the bottom up. It gets no press. Nobody talks about it as globalization, but look out. Too big to fail, and it's run by the people themselves. Thank you.
John Hatch, thank you.
Thank you. Too big to fail, too legit to quit, right? So I want to thank our speakers. They have both our moderator and our speaker have agreed to take questions. So if you could please just wait for this microphone. This is, again, being recorded for the radio, and Kari will bring it around to you to take your questions.
Mr. Hatch, thank you. I'm interested in your organizational process. How much oversight or follow-up do you have to provide in order to see that things stay on track?
Can you hear me? Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm already plugged in. I'm sorry. A lot. And it's not easy until you've done it for 15, 20 years. I mean, it starts with a great board of directors if you're a nonprofit, and they have to be really, really involved in the process of monitoring the control systems that get put in place that allow your field staff to go out there and be visiting the clients with great regularity. In the case of village banking, it's usually been a once a week visit to the community by a credit officer who sits and attends the meeting. Then you have to worry about our credit officers being honest. What are the controls to keep the credit officer from borrowing herself from these village banks, you know, because she's got a child who's sick? And so there's over the years, we have just gotten better from just through experience of creating controls that we know will work. And most of the time it has to do with, it got better, I think, in the long run, because eventually we got computers and we got portable assistants, you know, that you can carry around and capture data with. It's getting cheaper and cheaper and faster to record and analyze data, which means that today a person who misses a payment, we know about it at the top level of the community or the regional level of that bank by 8 hours. And it may be as little as 24 hours later before either somebody from the village bank or the credit officer herself is visiting the client to make sure everything's okay. You don't let any of these unpaid loans just happen. You go investigate why. And so these are lessons that have just taken years and years and years to slowly learn.
Thank you very much for coming. I've heard both of you speak before. And one of the major life forces in our world, unfortunately, is envy. And so I'm wondering, what about the guys?
What about God? Okay, it's like asking where was God during the convention? Is that what?
Yeah.
Oh, the guys.
The men.
Oh, I thought you were asking me of the GOD. Oh.
Yeah. Well, you and I.
Man, I was really going to get eloquent on that one. No. The guys. Okay, excellent question, and especially when I talk to Rotary groups, this is always question number one. What about the guys? My attitude is, this is not basically lending to women or lending to mothers. It's about lending to families. And so and in 60% of the cases, especially in 100% of the very poor cases, of a single mother doesn't have a guy. She's supporting that family all by herself. And so in those cases, the question isn't quite relevant. She's doing it all herself, and that's why we're lending to her. If there's a guy, that guy is a member of her family, and in the old days, it used to be as the program entered a community for the first time, the guys wanted to get involved. Oh, gee, this was cash flow. And they got a little excited and angry that they weren't being included as potential clients. Until we said, no, we're a women's group. We do this for the mothers. And we'll lend to your family. And in fact, it's your family who benefits and you with your wife benefits. So we just simply say the wife is the representative of your family. We're not trying to discriminate. If she wants to work with your cobbler business and you grow it together and that's the family business, fine. It's your family's money to decide how it's going to be invested. So the guys eventually become totally inclusive. And not only that, they actually become the first, they begin to start making sure their wife is ready to go and attend the meeting on time. They'll take care of the kids so the wife can attend that meeting. They get very supportive of this program after about 2 or 3 weeks. And it's very, very rare that they oppose it in a macho kind of way. And occasionally some will beat their wives and tell them they can't join the program. That happens. I'm not saying it doesn't, but it's a very, very tiny percentage of the whole.
We also find in our group, when we make loans, especially to Central Asia, we're making loans to women, but we're really not. Yeah, the men are just going through the process because that's how the family dynamics is. He goes and makes the micro loan, gives the money all to her. She's the one that actually figures out ways to create revenue to pay it back. So sometimes it's just the culture.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for coming up here. My question is, Jeffrey Sachs wrote a book with a similar title, The End of Poverty. I was just wondering whether you could comment on his sort of model for ending poverty.
Well, I think of Jeffrey Sachs' model as a little more eclectic than what I'm talking about. He maintains a major role for government, for the United Nations, for international aid agencies, for expanding resource flows through government to foreign governments to fund these kinds of projects. And I don't really believe in that approach. I don't think government does a good job of ending poverty. I think it's mainly when private sector nonprofits get into the business of organizing the people themselves into these self-help groups, that's where all the creativity and the effectiveness comes from. It doesn't come from the top down, Everett. I think it always comes from the bottom up, and that's why it's so successful and so self-sustaining. I don't want to support, you know, for years and years and years, I don't think it's necessary to support a big government and international aid infrastructure, except perhaps where I would agree with him is with our health agencies out there like UNICEF, who are working on very targeted ways on the health issues of the planet. I think that is a perfect role for us to support, and it's one of the roles that Results has targeted as one of the things they want to work on, and I think that's been a very productive partnership. So it's just a matter of emphasis, I think, between the two models of, I would almost give 80-90% of my preference to a bottom-up approach. She would probably give a much larger percentage to top-down.
Thank you for doing what you do. And my question was, with economic impairment, have you found the connection of, or do you know the statistic of women literacy? I mean, has it risen significantly with the empowerment of allowing them to do transactions, et cetera?
I would say that in terms of women who are borrowers, you're saying, or who are part of our village banks, our clients, so to speak, has that changed their literacy? In some cases, but I believe that where the impact has occurred is we have economically empowered these mothers to create little businesses which generate income that allow them to keep all of their school-aged children in school. And that's where the literacy, boys and girls, and that's where the real literacy gain happens, not with the mothers, but with their children. And it's really amazing that you can go into almost any microcredit program and start interviewing the borrowers, and you will find 90, 95, 100% of their clients have all of their elementary school-aged children in school, and most will finish elementary school, which is like twice or three times the education their mothers probably had. But still, the problem is, it's almost like there is a roof barrier at that level, because in the third world, to go on to high school is like, they don't have high schools in villages. And so you gotta get on a bus and travel 30 minutes, an hour, hour and a half, whatever, and at the end of the day come back. The cost just of that bus fare to and from that high school would consume all of that $2 to $3 of income that mother earns from her business. So it's just prohibitively expensive still. And that's why we want to look at scholarship programs and other tools for helping. And first of all, evaluating their children, giving them tests, and maybe creating scholarship programs based on who has demonstrated the best academic records and rewarding excellence in educational study and giving them scholarships. But it's so expensive that it'll be hard to do that for everybody. But at least we've gotten the first step of almost complete literacy now in the second generation.
Most interesting speech. I've kind of got a double question. How do you deal with the Muslim prescription of charging interest, for one? And do you run into resistance in societies where there are upper class money lenders who charge really exorbitant rates?
Okay, number one on the, we have a methodology which is now called Islamic lending. And we learned this by talking to a lot of their religious leaders, the mullahs, who, of course, we knew that the Quran prohibits interest on loans. But it does not prohibit partnerships. And so what we did in the Islamic programs is we simply entered into contractual relations with every client where we're saying, we're now partners in your business and we'll split the profits. And no interest on the loan. And we provide the capital, they provide the labor, and we split it 50-50. And that has been extraordinarily successful. In terms of the interest rates, I think my personal opinion is really that the money lenders in Latin America set a kind of a roof, an unconscionable roof on interest rates that is so high that it helps us, because they'll charge something like 10% a day on their loans. It's just egregious what they charge. And so along comes Finca with a loan that may be something like 3% a month, which even that seems high to us. But compared to the culture and the market in which they're in, it's almost like a gift when they look at 10% a day. So in essence, part of our success has been the indirect result of being able to come in at a much lower level than the money lenders. And secondly, we don't break ankles either, you know, like the money lenders do. And so we benefit so much from the contrast that it really is a beautiful way to be able to rapidly grow acceptance in our programs as an alternative to the money lender.
Hi. I was wondering whether you know how many countries or villages Finca has helped and reached?
I can't give you the exact number of villages, but we are in 21 countries. And our figures are just under 1 million clients. And just as a kind of a shorthand, I consider about every 20 clients as the equivalent of a village. So if you divide 1 million by 20, you'll come up, I think, with a fairly good estimate of groups that borrow from Finca or villages where Finca lends. Now that doesn't mean that there are 20 people in one group. That could be two or three groups with nine borrowers apiece. But just 20, a million by 20, and you'll have a pretty good idea. That's your arithmetic assignment. I don't have my calculator. You can calculate it in your head.
We normally figure on, and John, you chime in on this. For every microloan, we're impacting five people, even though we think it's just for a woman or for a, but normally that family, we're having an impact on five people.
Yeah, I would chime in, and my excuse is for not saying that earlier. When we say that we're reaching 160 million borrowers, that's 160 million families. Multiply that by five and you're over a billion human beings, and that's why I say we're a sixth or more of the population of the planet that's being benefited by the program. I would also add that in certain countries like Eastern Europe, where we also have lending operations, the family size, as in most of Europe, is much, much smaller. In fact, their population growth rates are down to zero and even minus numbers. And so you get very small families of two, three, and so you can't use in that area the five as a proxy for number of total people benefited. But you get to Africa and five works fine, Latin America it works fine. So I use it generally.
Hey, thank you for coming. You made a couple references and analogies to infrastructure. And my comment is on, you know, when you're making these contributions and impacts on the individual families and villages, but long-term economic change, I think, is proven it's tied to infrastructure within a region. And these families will never be able to really truly break out of poverty if there's not the infrastructure in their community or linking their villages to give them access to markets and access to trade. And now when you're mentioning about your international impact and the number of groups out there, are there any initiatives or any work being done to consolidate some of your financial resources and privatize foreign aid, if it will, because you're providing a service that the governments either cannot or will not for political reasons, and it seems like you just have so much power that you can impact this at the next, add another rung into your ladder.
Well, interesting. That I'd have to say that for us to kind of challenge government to do what it's supposed to do is not politically expedient. We believe that we do best when we work invisibly under the radar, because every time government wants to get involved with us, it's usually to control us or to stop us or to just... People are jealous of this success. Traditionally, everybody thinks, well, this is government's job. Well, and we're doing it better than government, and they get resentful of that. But it doesn't seem to help their effectiveness when they continue not to be as good at it as we are. But there are areas, and especially in road construction, where it would be critical, where we don't have the kind of resources to create anything that would be a paved road, a really commercially viable link between regional centers and stuff. That, those are really big projects that maybe World Bank and other institutions have to help out with. But there is opportunities for the pick and shovel kind of self-help road building that can be that can expand the economic viability of villages themselves. And then in the area of power generation, because there are no roads and because there are no telephone posts and electric lines out there, the cell phone is becoming the way you get around that. So you don't need the power grid, the electrical power grid anymore. We also have villages now who are, some of them are buying solar panels. And often it's the solar panel purchaser has a loan to start a little telephone charging system. And he has his little array of batteries linked to his solar panel storing the energy, and then he has a little strip of plug-ins, and then you see all these little cords to all these little cell phones that people in his village come to and charge up every day. And it saves them 20 minutes or an hour and a half to go into the village or to the nearest source of electricity. Technology is really amazing now, the way it's beginning to leapfrog over some of the old assumptions about physical infrastructure. We now have internet infrastructure that's beginning to replace it.
One of the things, I'll just briefly, just your concept about leverage, which I think is what ultimately what it's about. So we're looking at, and John may not necessarily agree with this, but we're looking at the SME sector, which is small and medium-sized enterprise, because not everybody wants to be a micro-entrepreneur. Not everyone's good at it. What they do want is a paying job. And so we're looking at maybe it would be better to make one loan, instead of making 100 loans to 100 different people, make one loan to a small and medium-sized enterprise who then employs 100 people. So, but that's the concept of leverage and in some ways infrastructure.
Well, there's also a smaller alternative to a micro alternative to what you're saying there, which I agree that can be part of an overall strategy that can be very useful, and you generate a lot of jobs that way. But another way you can generate jobs is that here are all these mothers who invested and sacrificed to get their kids through primary school. And now these kids are literate, and now these kids can absorb a kind of business training that was beyond their mothers. And so at this point, they are great, the children of our borrowers are becoming great potential clients for what you would call micro-franchising businesses, where they can become the manufacturer of solar panels. And then they can train other young people who work with them to become the sellers and the salesmen of these panels to all the nearby villages. And little by little, you start building franchises for building materials for houses, solar panels for electricity, tubes disagües, sewer lines. And the roofing tiles, and it just goes on and on and on. And I think another one of the next steps for micro-franchising is going to be moving into these areas that we call micro-franchising, which is just another term for what you guys are doing.
Yeah, that's me. Yeah.
On these one every now and then.
Yeah.
Is there any chance that possibly this corporation would be able to help the like the orphans and allow the orphans to get an education and all that? Because I understand it's a family and loan-orientated thing, but is there any possibility for an orphan helping?
You know, I think this is a question I think my wife can answer because she's worked with orphanages in El Salvador. What would you say to that, Mimi?
Well, I would say that, especially in Africa, there, where AIDS is such a problem, many, many orphans are taken in by our borrowers. Almost every single woman borrower in Africa has 1, 2, 3 orphans that she's taken in, and with her loan, then she's able to educate those children. I think we do work with an orphanage. Didn't we have a program at least once where we were working with orphanages?
I'm not recalling, but the point that
the
I would
point
have made
is that they
that,
do take in. I mean, it's not so much
take
like
care of their own.
Our culture where we say, oh, I don't have a bedroom, I don't have this, I don't have that. They just automatically take children in. And so as the women have more children that they're taking in, this loan will help to educate those children. One thing I did want to add that John didn't add, where we were talking about the children, our idea is to keep these babies alive. And then the first thing that people often say is, well, then we're going to have more population. What are we going to do with all these extra people? But it really has been proven that as women know and families know that their children will survive, they have less children. And as they move into the cities, they simply cannot afford those huge families that you can sometimes support on a farm. And so they are limiting their families. So by making sure that these babies do live, the people do have smaller and smaller families.
Great point, Mimi.
This is Roger Hutz again. I wanted to respond to the question about orphans a little bit. There are over 12 to 15 million AIDS orphans in sub-Saharan Africa and many in other parts of the developing world who have lost either one or both of their parents, and it's a real burden on society. And there's a lot of kids that are street kids and older siblings taking care of younger siblings and skipping a generation and grandparents trying to struggle to take care of all of their children's children. Very burdensome. Some of those caregivers are able to use microcredit, but one of the main global strategies for addressing that very serious problem is that the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria, which has been in existence about 10 years now, but has already mobilized, I think, about $23 billion of international resources, mostly donated by governments, U.S. government, Britain, Canada, Japan, what have you, and other private donations like from the Gates Foundation. Their model is for, let's say you're in Zambia or some sub-Saharan African country where there's a lot of kids that need to be taken care of. They need to get schooling and a roof over their head and everything else. Civil society organizations in that country can apply for grants to the Global Fund, and the Global Fund makes sure that before they start distributing any of these resources, that there is a coordinating mechanism within the society, that all the stakeholders and all the players are at the table doing something that's rational, being very accountable for the resources, but there is that substantial amount of resources that are funneled through the Global Fund to meet the basic needs of those orphans. And there's a heck of a lot more work to do, and the coverage is insufficient, but that's a main strategy that's happening on the planet to deal with it.
We have time for one more question.
He's had his hand up a lot.
Been a very interesting program today. My question is, do you have political problems with such countries as North Korea, Red China, Burma, Cuba, getting a program started in those countries?
Yes.
uh,
to give an example, China, I mean, I give a workshop on microcredit a year, and sometimes I get Chinese students, and they're all excited about getting microcredit into their country. But there, the ladder of access to capital is back to that old one with just a couple rungs up here, and the control over the banking system is a total political structure controlling that, to the point that not even Citibank, not even Bank of America is allowed to have a cash teller machine in China. I mean, the controls are total. And so it's very hard to kind of work in that environment until they loosen it up a bit. I think it's a matter of time. And I think they'll realize that it's a great instrument for bringing that, because poverty down has been, there's been great progress in China in terms of reducing the incidence of poverty. But the poverty that remains is still, they're one of the five countries where the biggest loss of children's lives are through infant malnutrition. So it makes sense for us and makes sense for them to find a way to get past that political structure. And perhaps it's an informal system where we just simply don't we agree just to go separate kind of parallel ways for mutual benefit of them and for the borrowers. But we haven't figured that one out yet. And in the meantime, where we've gotten so far really is, I call it, we work under a Harry Potter cloak of invisibility. And that's one of the essential elements of our success. Because why, when you lend to women, you lend to the least politically visible of that society, and so the political structure doesn't pay any attention to you because you're one of these programs that works with women. No threat there. So it's always been a help for us to be able to do that and avoid a whole lot of government controls and meddling because of that focus on women. So we'd like to just keep it that way, because the higher visibility you get, the more press coverage, and then everybody wants to, out of jealousy, stop you and criticize you and discredit you, just simply because that's how society works. If it's not their project, they want to destroy it.
Thank you very much. I want to thank our speaker and moderator for today's very informative discussion.
Thank you. Good question.
And I'd like to give a gift on behalf of the World Affairs Council to our speaker and encourage him to come back to Alaska. It's a pictorial book of Alaskans.
Ooh. Wow, okay.
Something that might be useful to him on his journey back. I also have a gift for our moderator, a past speaker of ours, something that might be useful for him in our weather. Alaska World Affairs Council umbrella. Hopefully you won't have too much use, but I think you just might.
Thank you. That was great.
And our next program, like I said, will be as a partnership with UAA on the 5th of October. We will be at the Student Union of UAA. It's a free program sponsored by UAA. Chris Abani will be the speaker, a Nigerian poet, an amazing storyteller, tells a story about his life as a teenager who wrote a book and was thrown into prison and death row in this very difficult nation of Nigeria. So keep on looking for our programs, and I hope to see you again soon.
Congratulations. Great group. Great group. Great group.
Great job.